Now you can hear me. Punch on your browser to slido.com and enter the code EmbryHills. There'll be an interactive quiz, question, polling tool that we will use throughout our class today to help us get some engagement from all of you. We want to welcome everyone. Thank you all for being here. I tried for nearly half an hour to get printed copies of today's lesson, and I have utterly failed. It may be possible while I'm here that some helper in the back will find some way to print the PDF that we uploaded to the website over the weekend and get them on paper for those of you who have not had a chance to see today's lesson. But I couldn't make it work, and I'm like a computer guy. But somehow, between three printers and two computers, none of them wanted to print. So there's hope for you, perhaps, if someone more skilled than I can make that happen. But regardless, we're here today. We're on the third lesson of a 13-lesson study of the life of Abraham. Abraham, the friend of God. We got started a week ago today. I was out of town last Wednesday, and I'm very grateful to Larry Brown for filling in for me and teaching lesson two. Larry is out of town this week, regrettably. He's going to miss, I think, the whole gospel meeting due to a work commitment that he has out of town today, but he may be available to help us later on in our classes. So let's review a little bit what we already know about Abraham, what we've already seen in our discussions about him. So this first, you guys are plugging in. If you haven't already, looks like there's about 37 of you. There are more than 37 of you in this room, but if you can, go ahead and join us, and I hope it will make the class a little bit more engaging for everybody. So our first review question here has to do with the early life of Abraham, which the Bible doesn't tell us a whole lot about. There aren't very many verses. There's very little to go on in the scripture to figure out what was Abram like before God called him, before he started his journey. But can we say that the Bible teaches that before the moment God first appeared to Abram, Abram was an ignorant, sinful, superstitious idol worshiper? Is that a true or a false statement? So let's see how we're going here. It's split, but clear majority, I think, are going for false, and that is, in fact, the right answer. The Bible does not teach that definitively. Now, there are a bunch of people who believe that, and we'll talk about it in just a second, and you know, no one can say definitively because there's so very little revealed to us in Scripture about Abram's life, but I'll hope to remind us why I'm going to claim that that's false. All right, we have printed lessons. Thank you, whoever our mysterious benefactor is. If anyone wants a copy of today's lesson, raise your hand, and someone will come and give you one. It may be helpful to you as we go through the rest of our material today. To deal with this question, we started last week with this article from the old National Geographic from 1966. It had this article that makes this assertion in its opening paragraphs about Abram's early life. For in his wanderings across the ancient world, Abraham the patriarch conceived a great and simple idea, the idea of a single almighty God. And what did we say was wrong with that statement? The conceived part, yes. We got a couple more lessons here. I don't think these ladies are wanting to answer questions, but I think their hands are up to get a lesson sheet. Thank you. It's this, restated another way. This is the National Geographic worldview, is that Abram lived in an idolatrous world, okay? He grew up in Ur of the Chaldeans, and they worshipped a moon god, and they built the ziggurat to worship him. And surrounded by all of that idolatry, Abram is unique because he came up with this idea that God exists, that there's an invisible, all-seeing, all-powerful God, and these other idols are all false. And so that idea is just an extension of this non-biblical worldview that we all evolved by chance. There is no creation. Man invented idols because he couldn't explain this unfamiliar world around him. And so the idea that there's one God controlling it all is just the next step in that evolution of mankind, along with, you know, the wheel and the transistor and the smartphone or whatever. God is just an invention that men have created throughout time. To refute that, we went to the scriptures to show specifically in Romans 1 what God has to say, what the Bible has to say about this period of time, about where idols came from, about why mankind started worshiping frogs and the sun and the moon and other created things. And we saw from this text that it starts with creation. Man did not evolve by chance, but God created man. Man did not invent idols because he was afraid of his world. They knew who God was, and they explicitly rejected God, did not honor him. They willfully turned away from him. And instead, in their foolishness, in their folly, they decided to invent all these idols and worship them instead as a way to allow them to indulge their own folly. And if you keep reading the chapter, all their own lusts, right? All the catalog of sins that you see described later on. And so but even in that environment, though, according to Paul, according to Romans 1, should it have been possible for someone to perceive that there's really an almighty, all-powerful, all-seeing God? Yeah, that's what this verse deals with. His eternal, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. If God is going to hold all these ancient people accountable for their rejection of him, it has to be possible for someone to look at the evidence here and conclude, yeah, God exists. Or to believe all the things they've heard about God, about the flood and Noah and all those things that were handed down in their society, and accept them as true and not be deceived by suppress the truth and unrighteousness, not be deceived by the popular idolatry that existed in their culture. And so the biblical view is, surrounded by the evidence of the existence of God, Abraham just recognizes that. He perceives that. He understands that these idols can't be controlling everything. There's got to be a higher power beyond that. And so we conclude that this is more of the biblical worldview of the sequence and not the National Geographic sequence of things. And so we raise this possibility. Could Abram have been a believer in God even before God appears to him in Mesopotamia? Because again, most of you who took the other answer to our question, that he was an ignorant, sinful, idol worshiper, until God came along and appeared to him and changed his mind for the first time. Whoa, I'm totally blown away by this concept that there's a God that exists that is not the moon or what have you. I'm suggesting that Abram could have maybe started to figure that out even beforehand, that he saw the evidence, that he understood there was a God. It's possible, according to the scripture, and if anyone was in a position to figure that out, Abram would have been that guy. And so our next question, I think, are we connected? Get ready. Yeah, here's the next question. Which of these facts that we read about in the Bible support this idea that Abram might have been seeking God even before God came along and appeared to him and called him and gave him these instructions and these promises that we've studied about? Is it the fact that Abram's family, his father and his brother Nahor, who were originally idol worshipers like Abram, they all became believers in God at some point before the story is done? Or can we look at evidence that God often chooses men who have already have his favor, they've already demonstrated some faithfulness? We talked about Noah was chosen to build the ark because he was blameless before God and had favor before him. Moses had unique characteristics that qualified him to serve in the role that God had for him. David was a man after God's own heart, and while other men didn't regard him as a kingly candidate, he had all the qualities that God was looking for. Could it have been that Abram, not being just the idol worshiper, but someone who was seeking God and showing already a degree of faith in God, was the guy that God would choose to be the model of faith for us today? Or Romans 1 makes clear that in Abram's time, while idol worshipers knowingly rejected God, those who were seeking God could see the evidence for him through the created world? Or is it all of these things? Okay, you guys figured it out. If there's an all of the above, you go for that one. Yeah, all of these things support this concept. None of them can prove it definitively, but neither can you prove definitively that Abram was an idol worshiper and didn't know anything about God before that. And so, here are some of the things we looked at last week. Now, there's even some extra biblical evidence that we can't rely on the same as the scriptures, but there are stories and accounts that have been handed down that Abram, you know, he was an astronomer who understood the workings of the stars and the planets and the moon, and used that knowledge and understanding to realize that there's got to be a God controlling that, not the other way around, not that these phases of the moon are controlling us, as the idol priest would have everyone believe, but the inverse. And there are stories that you can read about, you know, about Abram before that time. Can't vouch for their authenticity, but they're there. But the question last week was, why do we care? Why have I spent 10 minutes of review already talking about this concept? And I pointed us to a quote like this one. This is from a popular book that you can buy today on Amazon about Abraham. Why this particular man, the author asks. Did Abram turn from the idols of his ancestors and seek God? I'm saying he probably did. Did he make himself worthy of divine mercy? Far from it. Well, none of us are worthy of divine mercy. That's true. I'd go for that. The Lord chose Abram for reasons known only in heaven. And I'd probably agree with that too. The Bible doesn't tell us exactly why Abram was chosen. But we can say for certain that Abram did nothing to earn or deserve God's favor. I don't know if I can conclude that from the Bible. Nevertheless, the Lord appeared to this ignorant, sinful, superstitious idol worshiper and said, "Leave your native country." Why would this author be so adamant, despite the evidence we've just looked at, that Abram had to be this worthless idolater before God came along? Okay, thank you. Yes. Have you ever heard this idea, right, that there's nothing that any of us can do to turn to the Lord unless God appears to us or does something to us? It's the first tenet of the five Calvinist doctrines that we don't have time to go into TULIP, you know, but the T in the Calvinism TULIP is total depravity. And one of the outcomes of that is there's nothing that anyone could do on their own to ever do anything good at all whatsoever. So I bring this up because we all have to beware as we go through life's Abram's life of being over-influenced by Calvinist interpretations where they take their doctrine of salvation that they've cooked up from other passages in the New Testament and then they project that back onto Abram's life and reach conclusions like this. Why, he had to be this nobody who knew nothing about God before God appeared to him, because that's how God saves everybody. All of us are incapable of doing anything good or righteous or responding to God. How you resolve that with Romans 1 and the whole discussion about how men have no excuse for not seeing God and seeing the evidence and believing in him, I don't know. But somehow this is their mindset. It all fits together. And so they've got to interpret everything in through the lens of that theology, which is not supported by Scripture. So we got to be careful. As I said last week, even some of our own Bible material that I've seen about Abraham, I've seen hints of this Calvinistic view kind of coming through, and we got to be aware of that. We got to be careful that we don't do that. It's going to become more important later, especially when we get to chapter 15 and Romans chapter 4, with the whole justification by faith, as Janice was indicating. That's where it really comes into play, because Abram is one of the examples that they point to say this is how you're saved, by faith and faith alone. That's the mantra, right? Hopefully we'll see, looking at all of Abram's life, how that's not an accurate view of things. So that's review, lesson one. Let's review a little bit. Last week when I was not here, I think you guys were talking about how did Abram get from Ur of the Chaldeans, however it was, whatever his life was like before then, to the Promised Land? The story begins over here in Ur of the Chaldeans, which was a seaport probably in its time, a fairly urban, fairly cosmopolitan place that had mathematics and literature and civilization and all sorts of good things going for it. You see the ziggurat that's there. It was here that God first appeared to Abram, as we read about in Acts 7. And first told to leave his country, leave where he came from, and go to the land that God would show him, which wasn't Haran, but this is where they stopped for a while. And I think you guys discussed some of the possibilities of, you know, why did they stop there? But what event happened while they were in Haran that seems to have kickstarted phase two of this journey? His father died. Yes, his father was 205 years old when he died. And it's quite likely that part of the reason they stopped was just because he didn't want to keep going. We don't know exactly for sure. But then we get to Genesis 12, the call of Abram, where God tells him again, go forth from your country and do all these things. And you get this enunciation of the promises for the first time that God makes to him. And in response to that, it's not a straight line, by the way. There are stops along the way. We don't know exactly the route that he took, but this, I think, is roughly 600 miles, and this is roughly 500 miles, so 1,100 miles or so of journeying to get from Ur into the land of Canaan. And, of course, were there interstates back then? You know, could you hop on a Greyhound bus or a train? Or, you know, this is a very difficult sort of journey. Was it trailblazing in the sense that nobody would ever travel from here to there in any circumstance? Well, no. These were trade routes, so it's definitely possible to make this journey, but it takes time, it takes effort, it takes planning. You got to stop along the way, as we'll see here more in just a moment, but he underwent all that process to get into the land. And I'm trying to remember what the next question is. Well, I'll just pull it up here. So he gets to the land, and the Lord says to him, to your descendants I will give this land. But the review question here is chapter 12, which is what you guys looked at last Wednesday, is where we first see the promises. Which of these four choices best characterizes the promises that God made in Genesis 12? There are going to be more promises or more details or more amplification of promises later. But of these four, what do you think are that? Oh, look at that, 100% so far, right? Land, nation, name, seed, and blessing. We normally focus on the three, right? Land, nation, seed. That's what we teach the kids in Sunday school, right? But I will make your name great. His reputation, his fame would also be amplified. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. So in your own life, there will be a fulfillment of God's blessing, not just these longer-term things, which, in the big picture, those are the ones that matter, right? That a great nation would come out of Abraham. They would occupy this promised land that Abraham would sojourn in for the rest of his life. And eventually, through his seed, and Paul makes the argument that that's a singular noun, through one individual in particular who would descend from Abraham, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And that's how we connect into Abram's promise. But these promises are first laid out for Abram here in chapter 12. And it is presented in the form of a covenant that we'll talk about more when we get to chapter 15. But in along with the promises are these commands to finish the job here, leave your country, leave your father's house. He's dead now. You can keep moving. And come into the land that I will show you. And so, in chapter 12, we see the promises there that we just described. We see Abram obeys the Lord, went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. We're going to talk about Lot more in our next lesson when we get to chapter 13. Was taking Lot with him a violation of God's directive here? We'll debate that question. It certainly caused additional complication in Abram's life, as we'll see. But was it really disobedience? Was it lack of faith? We'll talk about that some more later. Abram was 75 years old when they left. They had accumulated a bunch of stuff while they were in Haran, which I think in our last lesson we pointed out that might have been part of the purpose of the stay there, is that they had accumulated more stuff which might enable them to sort of set up shop, as it were, in Canaan once they finally got there. But they come into the land, and what activities do you see in these verses that Abram, how does he spend his time now that he's finally come into the promised land? What two things primarily, or maybe three, do you see him doing? Building altars, right? He builds more than one, right? One first in Shechem, which is the place where he first comes in to the land. The Lord appears to him there, to your descendants I will give this land. So we've identified exactly what land we're talking about. It's not the land I'm going to show you. You're here now. So in response to that, he builds an altar to the Lord who appeared to him there. And of course, what do we associate with altar building? What do you build an altar for? Worshiping God, honoring God, making sacrifices to God. Now, did Abram invent the idea of using an altar for that kind of purpose? Cain and Abel built altars, right? Or made sacrifices, at least. The Canaanites who lived in this land, they had all kinds of altars that they used for their worship, but what were they worshiping? You know, some sort of idol, some sort of tree, or, you know, they had some object that they had created to worship, which would have distinguished Abram's altar, because what was there at the altar for Abram to worship? What's that? The blood of an animal, yes, but the Canaanites probably sacrificed animals too. What was missing from Abram's altar? An idol. There was no physical representation of what he was worshiping, right? So Abram's going to be somewhat of an oddball among all these Canaanites among whom he's dwelling, because he's not worshiping some graven image or molten image. He's built this altar, you know, to whoever. To this God you can't see. So what other purpose besides worshiping God would building altars and offering worship serve as Abram goes through the land? Okay, I think that's part of it, the fact that he builds it here, and then he's going to build another one in Bethel. I'll go ahead, you know, it's right there on the screen, right? He moves further south, pitching his tent, built another altar. He's going to return to that altar before. These are special places that commemorate, you know, the appearance that God made to him here. So it is a form of remembrance. But what purpose? Yeah, testimony. Witnessing, you know, the fact that I'm here in the midst of all you pagan idolaters and I'm building my altar here to the true God, and those around him can see that and wonder. There are other things about Abram's life that are going to make his neighbors scratch their head and wonder about some things, and there's some parallels to our lives, right? We're sojourners in a world surrounded by people who don't honor God, and there should be things about our lives that make them scratch their head and wonder, why are they like that? Why do they do that? So we can relate to Abram in that sense. David, yes?
The phrase called on the name of the Lord can mean calling on God for help or blessing.
Right.
It can also mean declaring God's name.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Makes that evangelism, I think, more active than just, oh, look, what's that guy doing? Let's go find out.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's more like he's telling people.
Right. I think you're right. And again, the stories we read about Abram that aren't in the Bible from his early life when he was in Ur suggest that he was like that, that he was vocal about his faith in this God, and he went so far as to oppose the pagan worshipers who would teach otherwise. So that would be consistent with that character if his intent is to tell others and let people know who the God is that he's worshiping and why he's worshiping them. The other activity besides building altars, and we've already mentioned that, is what? Tent pitching. Yeah, journeying through the land. He's surveying the land. He's laying claim to this land, which again would kind of seem odd to those surrounding him, is that he doesn't own any of it. He's just moving his tent, but shows that he has a future view of life. He's looking to the promises that God have made down the road and believing in what God has promised him. While he might not himself ever own this land, his descendants will, and he's declaring that through his sojourning through that land. All right, we got to get to today's lesson. That's all review. Now we get to the rest of chapter 12 and a few verses in chapter 13. He gets to the land, the promised land, after 1,100 miles of journeying through these caravan routes and bringing Sarah and Lot with him into the promised land. He's surveying the land, going through it. He's worshiping God, honoring God, testifying about God. And then what happens? There's nothing to eat. Yeah, there's a famine. Which, how would you think your lesson sheet ask? If you're in Abram's shoes, what do you make of that? You're in this land that God has promised you, and now all of a sudden there's nothing to eat. There's a famine. Is that going to be an encouragement to you, or what might be going through your mind? Okay, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. We came all this way from home and from Haran, where they had all those, you know, great agricultural resources, and now we're out here and there's not enough food to feed our flocks, there's no grain for us to eat. And how bad of a famine was it? It was severe in the land. And so what does he decide to do? Goes down to Egypt. Have we read about, well, we haven't read about this before. Are we going to read about this again? The question is, were famines, food shortages in the land of Canaan a common thing? And was it maybe pretty conventional for the folks who lived there when there was a famine to go down to Egypt to get food? Why would Egypt maybe have food to spare when Canaan did not, you think? Because of the Nile, okay? Not every famine is a global event, right? Now, we get to Joseph's time, right? That was a pretty bad one over multiple years, and it did affect, people came from all over the world to Egypt because of, you know, they had food there, and they were prepared because of what God had done through Joseph. But sometimes there's just a famine in the land, you know, not enough rain in a season or two, and there's not enough sustenance in the land, whereas the Nile, you know, the headwaters of the Nile come from far away, and, you know, it's irrigated there, and there could well have been plenty of food available in Egypt. So was it sort of a logical step to take to say, we're going to go down to Egypt in order to sojourn there? Was this a good decision, a wise decision, a faithful decision? What do you think of this decision? Well, I'll go ahead and just ask the question. His decision to leave the promised land after God had led him there and go down to Egypt during a time of famine, how do we want to view that? Are we saying this is Abram just giving up on God and fleeing to Pharaoh for deliverance? Okay. Everything God's told me, it's just a bunch of hooey. You know, he's just making that up. You know, if he was serious about these promises, I wouldn't be starving here with my family and all of my flocks. Or do we think that his decision was a failure on his part for not seeking God first? There's no evidence here that he ever sat down and said, God, what should I do? Tell me where I should go. Should I stay? Should I go? Will you take care of me? And instead, he just came up with this plan on his own and left out there. Or was this decision more about giving up on God and fleeing to Pharaoh for deliverance? Oh, it changes orders. That's right. Okay. I already said that one. The first one, Abram doing the best he could based on his understanding of God's will. There's no right or wrong answer for this one, by the way. You don't get points for this. This is an opinion question to see what the temperature of the room is. And so what I see here is that most of you seem to think that Abraham is doing the best that he can based on what God has told him. A lot of you are going to think, and this is a very popular idea, too, in the literature, that he should have consulted God first, right? Don't just go out and come up with things and do what you can. Some of you are thinking, this is Abram giving up on God. Maybe there's a step in between where he hasn't completely given up on God, but if he had enough faith in God, he would have just stayed put where he was and just let God take care of things and not abandon the promised land that God had brought him into. Yes. Oh, absolutely, it was. Yeah, he's going along with the crowd, which, you know, is there really a moral dimension to where are we going to get food? Not necessarily. What makes Abram's case unique is that God had led him here and told him this is the promised land, and now the promised land isn't looking so good, and he's considering going elsewhere. So my next question, there's two other stories that are very similar to this in different ways. And the one I want to highlight is in chapter 26 of Genesis. Abram's son, like a quarter century after this, or no, longer than that. The quarter century was when he goes to Abimelech and has the same thing with Sarah. But later, in Isaac's life, there's a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac does the same thing. He first goes to the Philistines and appears to be intending to go to Egypt to get food like everybody else. But what stops him? Or who stops him? God does. God appears to him and says, do not go into Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land and I will be with you. And if you keep reading that chapter, this is really the first time that Isaac himself encounters the promises, right? The covenant that God had made with Abraham. Isaac's already had kids by now. He's, you know, grown up and he's further along in life. But this is where God sort of makes the deal with Isaac. And part of that deal is, don't leave. You need to stay here. Remember, Isaac's never been outside the promised land. Abraham made it very clear to his servant, don't let my son go back to Haran to find a wife, you know, and don't let him find a wife here. You go back there and bring a bride back here. I do not want him to leave this land. That was very important to him for reasons we'll talk about when we get to that chapter. But here is the first time Isaac's really thinking about venturing outside the boundaries of the promised land, and God stops him and tells him to stay here, and he reiterates the promises that he's going to go there. So was the same true for Abram? Did God appear to Abram and tell him, don't go? No, he didn't. Is this a, and for those of you who may have, you know, he should have asked God first, what should he do? Part of your lesson sheet is find some examples for me of other situations where God or Abram had a problem, and he goes to initiate a conversation with God to seek the Lord's advice about how he should solve the problem. What'd y'all come up with? Anyone think of an example? Yeah, they had a long conversation about that, but who initiated that conversation? God shows up on the scene and gives Abraham an opportunity to talk. The correct answer is on the screen. There aren't any. I challenge you to find any case recorded for us in Scripture where Abram is able to pick up the phone and I need to talk to God. I got me a problem here that I'm wrestling with, and I need God's guidance and insight and wisdom. I've got questions. He's got answers. I want to talk to God. God, can you talk to me? It's not there, okay? Abram, instead, is more like us. We have communication from God. We have a revelation of God's will. And it's up to us to do the best we can to figure out what his will is and apply it in our lives. In many ways, Abram was like this. Yes, there are going to be extensive conversations that God has with the Lord. But in, I believe, every case, it's the Lord that decides when Abraham gets an audience with God. And usually it's when he needs it for one reason or another. But there are plenty of times where I imagine Abram had questions or could have used some insight from God, and he's either is not able or does not initiate it at all. Yes?
But also like us, when he does the best he can, like with Hagar,
sometimes
he gets it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So, Paula, do you have your hand up? Yes. Right. Oh, yeah. There's some good things. Yes, absolutely. There were good things that came out of this trip to Egypt. We'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk more about this based on his understanding of God's will. Because was his understanding perfect? Was it complete? No, in both cases. It's going to improve over time. And we'll talk about how that applies to us too. But there are those, again, if you read certain books, that were saying, why Abram here was just weak in his faith. He should never have left that. If he really trusted in God, he would have just stayed put and God would have saved him somehow. That's borderline to me, putting God to the test, right? I don't think he had anything revealed from God that said, you stay here and I will take care of you no matter what happens. If there's an opportunity to go get food in Egypt that doesn't really violate anything else God has said, I think there's nothing really wrong with that. There are those who say, well, he should have asked God first before he went. I don't think he had the ability to ask God. And he prayed, certainly. But are there times that we pray and we want answers to questions and we don't get a specific answer from God about a specific challenge or problem that we're dealing with, and we've got to figure it out from what God has revealed to us? I think that's the situation we're in. And so Abram mimics that in a lot of different ways. So our next question, I can't remember what it is. Yeah, okay, so he's going to Egypt. We're done talking about that. The decision's been made. They're going down there to get food. But then this famous story about Abram's relationship with his wife. His wife happens to be also his sister, as he explains later. They had the same father, but different mothers. And we'll talk more about that maybe when we get to chapter 20. But the question I have for you here is, Abram first arranged with Sarai to hide the fact that they were married and emphasize instead their half-sibling relationship. When did he do that? At the beginning of their travels, as soon as they left home, just before they left Canaan on their way down to Egypt, just before they got to Egypt as they were getting close, or it's kind of on the spur of the moment when the topic came up when Pharaoh and his people were asking about them. Which of these do we think is accurate? Okay, we're getting a pretty dominant result, but it's not the right one. Okay, if you read chapter 12 all by itself, yes, that's the sequence of events. Before they arrived in Egypt, as they're approaching there, Abram has this conversation. Do me this solid here. Just say you're my sister and we're not married. But when you read chapter 20, Abram does the same thing again 25 years later in a different context. But there he explains that when God first sent us wandering from my father's house, this was the arrangement that I had with Sarai. This was a standing arrangement that they had. Because remember, they've been sojourning for a while. It isn't like we're safe and secure at home, and this is the first time we've ever had to go someplace strange where we might encounter some foreign ruler who might look upon my wife and want to take her as his own. They've been to Damascus. They've probably been through Babylon. They've been through a lot of places on their journey where this kind of arrangement might come into play. We don't have all those encounters recorded for us, of course. But the arrangement was something that seems to have been on his mind from day one, or at least very early in their sequence. So that trick question. But you know, you got to have something to separate the wheat from the chaff, right? Anyway, so here's the story, right? It came about when he came near to Egypt, yes, and this that he said to his wife, "You're a beautiful woman," and people will debate, how can a 65-year-old woman be beautiful? That's a different topic, but everyone seems to agree she was attractive in some capacity. And when the Egyptians see you, they're going to want to, they're going to conclude that we're married and they're going to kill me, but they'll let you live. Please say that you are my sister so that it will go well with me because of you and that I may live on account of you. Can we commend Abram's ethics here? Let me just say that if we study this story and the one thing we came out that we take away from it is don't ever lie because it's going to get you in trouble. Don't even tell half-truths because those are lies too and those will get you into trouble. We're missing the point of this story. What's the greater evil that's going on here? I mean, Abram's desperate for food. He's a refugee trying to keep his family alive. He's pretty convinced that one way or the other, the Egyptians are going to take Sarai. And they're either going to take her and kill him, or they'll take her and be nice to him. Okay? And what's causing that, the whole the Egyptians are going to take her? Is it anything Abram's doing? Is it anything that God's doing? Who's the one responsible for that environment? The rulers, Pharaoh, these wicked people who think that they can just take whatever they want without concern. Now, interestingly, they seem to have some respect for marriage. It's very likely that, you know, this whole idea that they will kill me was a valid concern. We're going to see, we'll go down here later, we'll see that Pharaoh is all upset. You know, why did you do this to me? Well, there's an answer for that. Because you would have killed me if I hadn't otherwise. Sure, it's one thing after God wreaks all these plagues upon the house of Pharaoh because of Sarai, and Pharaoh comes to understand, whoa, there's something about this Abram guy and his wife that I don't want anything to do with them. They've got powers that I don't want to understand. And in that context say, you know, why did you lie to me? I would never have done any harm to you, Abram, to take your wife who I wanted if I had known. Take away the plagues and the power of God. If Abram was just some run-of-the-mill refugee with a beautiful wife, it's quite likely that they would not have, you know, treated him kindly or honored his claim that she was my wife. So I'm telling the story. We got to, yes, quickly. Yeah, yeah. Right. Tough choices, though, either way. You know, Abram would have had to say, yes, Pharaoh, this is my wife, and if you want her, you're going to have to come through me and the God that sent me here. Would that be putting God to the test, maybe? Did Abraham have absolute confidence that God, you know, this is a fiery furnace kind of situation? I don't know. We don't know what the alternative universe would have been had Abram have done that. But I'm going to show you some things about what did happen that make me think this is what God intended to happen all along, right? So, indeed, they take Sarah into the harem. Indeed, they give Abram all this stuff because he was Sarai's sister. But as we said, these great plagues come about because of that. And we don't know the details of what they were or how Pharaoh figured out what the truth was. But Pharaoh's all upset with Abram for what he's done, and he sends them out with all their stuff and kicks him out of Egypt. Does the fact that Pharaoh is all upset with Abram, is that equivalent to God was all upset with Abram for what he had done here? Who's being punished in this story? Pharaoh is being punished, and rightly so, given who he was and his character and the kind of things that he did. Abram's more the victim here. Now, we can't commend everything that he does, but as Paul said, he comes out of this in pretty good shape. So, when you think about this story, there's way more going on in this story than just, you know, what is Abram going to do for his food? Think of the parallels, if you haven't already, right, between what happens to Abram and what will happen to his descendants, Israel, later in the book of Genesis. Okay, they both went to Egypt during a famine. Okay, remember Jacob and his 12 sons and the famine that Joseph had foretold? That's how the sons of Israel got to be in Egypt in the first place, a famine, just like Abram did. There were evils in both cases on the part of the Egyptians, okay? The evil of abduction, this policy that Pharaoh seems to have had, that he'll take whatever woman he wants and kill whoever he has to kill to have her, was an evil situation that God's people found themselves in, and it was a tight spot. Eventually, the Israelites found themselves oppressed and enslaved under the power of Egypt. You see the deception of Abraham in talking about his sister, but don't you see some evidence of deception elsewhere in the story? Remember when Moses was born, what did his parents have to do? They had to hide him. Isn't hiding a form of deception? Shouldn't they have just said, God will protect this child? I have a newborn child. I dare you to take his life. God will intervene. They hid him in the basket, right? Or they hid him for 3 months and then in the basket. Joseph deployed deception when his brothers came. For what purpose? You remember? He was worried about his little brother, Benjamin, who he knew would be his dad's favorite. And so he misrepresented who he was and framed them for disobedience that they weren't actually guilty of in order to bring his whole family safe and secure into Egypt. So we see other instances where not telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth involved in the story of Israel in Egypt. But the bigger things, certainly the plagues that we see come upon Pharaoh in Abram's time, also happened in the time of the Exodus. Pharaoh gets so fed up with these Hebrews that he kicks them out in both cases. And in both cases, they leave Egypt way better off materially than they had been before. Exodus talks about how they plundered the Egyptians upon leaving, without going into all those details. In other words, what happens to Abram in Egypt is in so many ways a foreshadowing of what's going to happen to Abram's descendants in Egypt. Is that an accident? I don't think so. I think God knew how this was going to happen. God let this play out. I think this is why God didn't stop him from going to Egypt. God had a purpose for him going to Egypt. And the next question, I forgot one. They both end up back in the promised land after this whole episode is over. So one last question on the quiz. This sojourn in Egypt also foreshadows the experience of what other Bible character of these four? Elijah, David, Jesus, Paul. Very good. Out of Egypt I will call my son. Even that seed through whom all the earth would be blessed, he went to Egypt to escape the evil of a wicked king. Avoid that difficulty. So you got all that. So who's our winner today? Alex, is that Cruttendon? Are you here? Another Alex? There are no prizes. Oh, very good. Well done. But the last question we want to look at. If the lesson isn't, don't ever lie because you'll get in trouble. That's a valid lesson, but that's not the big lesson. What lesson do you think Abram takes away from Egypt? I mean, it was a difficult experience, but by the time he's home and it's all behind him, what do you think Abram has learned about God? I'm sorry? It increased his faith, because what has he seen God do? Bless him. Yeah. It looked like God had nothing going. God was causing this famine. God had put him in this bind. God had forgotten everything. But in fact, God blesses him. And the passage I want us to think about is from Romans 8. We know that God causes all things to work together for those who love God. And the end of the chapter, what will separate us from the love of Christ? All these things, including famine, okay? The same lesson applies to us. Even though these things will still happen, famine and other persecution, does that mean God has forgotten us? Not at all. We still have the blessings of God, and no matter what may happen to us, God will keep his promise. Abram learned that in Egypt, and he's going to remember that, I think, in our next couple of stories. Thank you all for your attention today.